Good morning and welcome to everyone. So early on Sunday morning, thank you for adjusting your schedule this 1 week only. It's good to see all of you. In a time of rising anti-Semitism, it's fitting to seek guidance from Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower. And so we are greatly honored to have Westminster member Dr. Suzanne Free with us to lead a 3-week series on the sunflower. Let's give her a hearty welcome.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Again, I want to add my thanks for getting up so early to be here. When we originally planned this 3-week teaching event, I don't think either of us were thinking ahead to what this Sunday would require of us. But anyway, glad to be here. And I have been here before, actually, before I joined in 2016. I came to talk about a trip I took with Classrooms Without Borders to Poland to study the Holocaust and to tour the concentration camps. And your response to that was so warm and this church so alive that I was sorry we live so far away in Moon Township. Since then, we have come. This is my husband, John Free, who's a retired Presbyterian minister. And every Sunday that he is not preaching somewhere in the presbytery in these little churches that can't afford pastors much anymore, we would come here and always came for the Christmas Eve service. But after we got through COVID and I shopped around in a few other places that were closer to my house, I decided to join your flock, this flock, my flock, in December. And it feels like home. In January of this past year, Noah Schoen, I don't know how many of you were here for that. He came to talk about the alarming rise of anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world. That evening, after he spoke, I met Flo Sheep, who said that we should try to keep this discussion going. I emailed Joe and asked if I could have 3 Sundays in a row, and she said, we have 3 Sundays left in June. So here we are. I wanted to discuss an amazing book. Some of you, does anyone already have this book or has read it? Wonderful, wonderful. It's called The Sunflower on the Possibilities and Limits of Forgiveness, written by Simon Wiesenthal, a Holocaust survivor, and famous for being for finding, flushing out, and bringing to justice over 1,000 Nazi war criminals in hiding. My thanks to Sarah for putting 2 documents on the Westminster website. I also have copies of the original syllabus for this course. If anybody wants print, I would be one of them. This is my high-tech visual aids section here. I am not good with technology. This is at least makes me comfortable. As we know from our experience of Holy Week and from the nearly constant news around the world, violent conflict, the war between our worse and better natures never ends. Though The Sunflower was written over half a century ago, this collection of essays seems to me to be as relevant now as it was then, maybe even more so. Wiesenthal knew from experience, both during the war and in 50 years of locating Nazi war criminals and bringing them to justice, that human beings can be appallingly brutal and dim-witted, or amazingly heroic and self-sacrificing. If he were living today, he would say that Germans and Jews, Christians and Muslims, Republicans and Democrats can be individually kind, compassionate, and profoundly good people, or what Noah called jerks, arrogant, cruel, even sociopathic, or even both at different times. I thank you for your willingness to take up the subject matter of Jewish persecution again, this time from a more Christian vantage point. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. It's hard to hear that we still, after so many thousands of years of evolution, still like to feel that the people that sitting on this side are better than the people sitting on that side. It seems to be an old habit in us, and it's hard to grow out of. One day, I pray to God to help me love my enemies. And the next, I am filled with rage at the bombing of a maternity hospital, the blowing up of mothers trying to give birth in random missile strikes, that I can hardly contain my instinct for revenge. As Americans, our heart and souls are with the Statue of Liberty, mother of exiles. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. And yet I wasn't surprised when millions cheered Donald Trump's plan for building walls around our borders to keep out drug dealers, terrorists, and rivers of desperate refugees. It's an attractively simple solution, as if border guards and gatekeepers cannot be bribed. From the cross, Jesus asked God to forgive those who put him there, a good reference point for us today. But perhaps you've wondered, as I have sometimes, especially at the end of a Maundy Thursday tenebrae service, when all around the world altars are draped in black and stripped, might God have not forgiven those who put him there if Jesus hadn't asked? What sins is God inclined to forgive if we ask? What if we are too blind or lost or damaged to ask? In my classroom every year, students wrestled with Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. Do you remember reading this book in high school? I think they still teach it in some places. In that book, a genuinely devout Puritan minister commits adultery, sincerely repents of it, is tortured by it, but cannot find the courage to confess it to his congregation, even as Hester Prynne gives birth to their daughter. She takes all the blame and shame upon herself for 7 years. She lives a bleak life, an outcast, while his reputation for piety and powerful preaching grows larger and larger. Is such hypocrisy forgivable? If so, on what grounds? The Catholic Church has been wrestling with far worse hypocrisy in priests' abuse of children's innocence and trust, and then higher-ups covering it up, keeping it secret. Hawthorne struggled with the terms and limits of forgiveness all his life, perhaps because his great-grandfather was one of the Salem witch trial judges, and he sent many innocent people to their deaths. Old Judge Hawthorne believed he was doing God's will, but he was not. He was murdering good people. And so his great-grandson, in story after story, posed the same question. Is there such a thing as an unpardonable sin? Because he never confessed that error, even though later he realized that it was wrong. Is there a sin so great that even God can't forgive it? Traditionally, despair has been that sin because it puts limits on God's power. But if Hawthorne could have looked ahead to the Holocaust, he might have never bothered to pick up his pen again. Can God forgive genocide? As one of the essayists, this is my visual aid or one of them, puts it in The Sunflower, Lawrence Langer, this event bursts every frame we try to put around it. We can scarcely conceive of the systematic murder of tens of thousands of people a day in multiple camps for years. Eliminationist anti-Semitism, the historians call it. Kill them all. You and I can't imagine what being inside one of Himmler's factories of death was really like. Though we can come a little closer by seeing the winner of both the Academy Award and the Golden Globe Award for Best Foreign Language Film in 2015 called Son of Saul. Have any of you seen it by any chance? It was not in a lot of theaters. The film follows one Hungarian Jewish prisoner around Auschwitz-Birkenau for 2 days in October of 1944, right before a desperate escape attempt, which actually did take place there, scared the Nazis. This prisoner, Saul, belongs to a special unit of able-bodied Jews who did the Nazis' dirtiest work for them in exchange for a little extra food and maybe the chance to live an extra month or two. They loaded and unloaded the gas chambers. They looted the prisoners' meager possessions while they were being gassed. They rammed the corpses into the ovens as fast as fire could consume them and shoveled the ashes into ponds and rivers, tons and tons of ashes. But one day, Saul sees that a little boy has somehow survived the gas chamber. As the boy is struggling to breathe, only half conscious, a camp doctor is called in, who takes the vital signs of the child to try to determine how and why he survived the poison gas. And then he promptly smothers the boy with his hand. From that moment, Saul perceives that child as his son. So should we all. And he is determined to keep the boy's body out of the ovens. Cremation is against traditional Jewish law. So you can imagine the spiritual agony it was for Jews to see their families literally going up in smoke day and night. Over the next day and night, Saul frantically searches for a rabbi in the camp who will help him give this boy a decent Jewish burial somehow. Though this film also won the grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival, I can't say I would recommend it to you. It is very hard to watch, and it doesn't end well. How could it? But it does assert humanity and the importance of respect for the living and the dead. It asserts the crucial importance of religious ritual, especially in Saul's heart-rending and futile attempt to bathe the boy's body. Forgiveness of the SS officers who run the camp never occurs to Saul, nor does it occur to any of the SS to ask for it. But here's an irony and a symptom of what's going on with us. Son of Saul won one Academy Award. Obviously, the subject of forgiveness is too huge to take on in two or three Sunday school classes. But Wiesenthal has done us a great service by narrowing the focus on this subject for us. In The Sunflower, he tells us about one thing that happened to him purely by chance on one afternoon in one concentration camp. One day, a dying SS officer summons him to his bedside. The man is in great physical and psychological pain. He proceeds to tell Wiesenthal his life story, insisting that he hold his hand. It takes him 2 hours to confess all his sins. Then he asks Wiesenthal to forgive him for the atrocity he has committed against the Jews so he can die in peace. Wiesenthal tells us that after listening to his confession, he could not do it. Starving and exhausted himself, he simply got up and walked away in silence. But being the man he was, that event created a moral dilemma for Wiesenthal that haunted him for the rest of his life, culminating in his writing of a 95-page essay called The Sunflower, which he threw out to the world in 1969 with a question: what would you have done in my place? He got 53 responses, written by some of the best minds and hearts of the 20th century. And they're all here. A symposium on forgiveness in one volume, including essays by the Dalai Lama, Albert Speer, Robert Coles, Desmond Tutu, Robert McAfee Brown, Martin Marty, Primo Levi, many more, as well as witnesses and victims of attempted genocide in Bosnia, Cambodia, China, and Tibet. I'd like to spend most of the rest of our time this morning summarizing his original essay about what happened to him that day. Please read it if you can between now and when we meet again. We have a few copies here that are available to you. Sarah, where's Sarah?
Next door.
Okay. Anyway, she purchased them. I guess you would have to buy them from her. They're $11, which is not too bad. If you look at the syllabus, which she put on the website, you will see that this course was originally designed for discussion to take place over a period of 11 days. How I wish we had 11 days. But we can do a lot, nevertheless. We will be skipping, when you take a look at the syllabus, we will be skipping days 1 through 4 altogether. But if you can, please read for next Sunday the essays that are highlighted from day 5 through 8. They are short, trust me. They're mostly around 2 to 4 pages long. Then for June 16th, read the highlighted essays for day 9 to 11. I promise you it's worth it. Every one of them will contribute something new to your thinking about forgiveness. Maybe take notes. Write down any questions that occur to you as you are reading, or any particular points you would like to discuss. If you read an essay not highlighted and think we should all take a look at it, by all means, please suggest it next time. The last page of the syllabus provides some basic questions you might want to ponder as you begin to read the essays. And I will list 10 of them very quickly here. 1, why is murder unforgivable in the Jewish tradition? Is it simple logic? The only people with the power to forgive the SS officer for his murders are dead. They're ashes. He can't ask, and they can't answer. That's one definition of hell, irrevocable consequences. 2, what is human nature? Is inhumanity a part of being human? And this takes us all the way back to Genesis. 3, how old is the idea of forgiveness? Does it predate Judaism and Christianity? Does it exist in Buddhism, in Islam, in Hinduism? Confucius said, he who refuses to forgive breaks the bridge over which he too must cross. You may be surprised by what people of faith all around the world have in common on this subject, but also in what interesting ways we differ. 4, what is the origin of the idea of legal justice? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, as an alternative to unlimited revenge. 5, who is the first to propose forgiveness as an alternative to justice? Forgiveness not as a legal matter, like a presidential pardon or the formal canceling of an unpaid debt, but as a personal moral decision. On what terms can such forgiveness be granted? Are there no terms at all? 6, what is the Jewish concept of teshuva, deliverance from evil for both perpetrator and victim? It is not unconditional. What is its condition? Reading over Psalm 103 may help with this one. As far as east is from the west, so far has God removed our sins from us. But on what condition? 7, what about repentance? How much is enough to warrant forgiveness for particularly vicious crimes, like flying airplanes into buildings or enslaving whole races of people perceived to be inferior? How can we know if repentance is sincere? And even if one is forgiven, must there not still be some kind of penance or punishment to follow? 8, what role does conscience play, in time of war? Carl committed unspeakable atrocities. Only on his deathbed did they come back to haunt him. Should he die in peace? It never occurs to him to free Wiesenthal, who lives in constant fear of death. It never occurs to him to even offer him a glass of water or a crust of bread for sitting there and listening to his outpouring for 2 hours. Does he have any idea that he is still sinning against a Jew? 9, what about different kinds and degrees of guilt? In the Holocaust, what of the silent bystanders who didn't kill anyone during the war, but never uttered a single word of public protest? I wonder if I would have been one of them. As Wiesenthal writes, all during the war, there were millions of families anxious only for peace and quiet in their own little nests. These were the mounting blocks by which the criminals climbed to power and kept it. And so are there such nests in Russia and Ukraine and Israel and Gaza and the United States. We all want to feel safe, to protect the security of our children and grandchildren. But in the eyes of God, are silent bystanders any less guilty than the SS officer or an ISIS terrorist? If so, how should we judge them? And finally, can we wriggle out of all of this by saying that only God can judge? But then why bother with the Nuremberg trials or the Department of Homeland Security? Let me see how we're doing time-wise here. I wanted to give you a brief biography of Wiesenthal's life for context and background, but in the interest of time, so we do have time for questions and discussion, I'm going to shorten it into a few sentences. He was in 5 concentration camps over a period of 4 years, was reduced to a skeleton, tried to kill himself twice after he heard that his wife was dead in another camp. Together, he and his wife lost a total of 89 relatives in the Holocaust. But he survived, and in fact, so did his wife. Slowly, they both made their way back to health. They were reunited and able to have one child, a daughter, Paulinka. Simon devoted the rest of his life to rooting out Nazi war criminals in hiding and bringing them into a courtroom. I'm going to add just one movie recommendation. This one's better. It even has a somewhat happy ending. Wiesenthal was credited with at least contributing to the capture of Final Solution architect Adolf Eichmann in 1961. And there is a movie about how they did that. And it is suspenseful and excellent. It's called Operation Finale. And Ben Kingsley plays Adolf Eichmann. Have any of you seen it by any chance? Good movie? Yeah. He was also credited with bringing in Gestapo worker Carl Silberbauer, who was responsible for the arrest of Anne Frank. Okay. Let me now give you a synopsis of the first essay in this book, written by Wiesenthal himself. When the Sunflower begins, he is a haggard prisoner in Lemberg concentration camp in occupied Poland. He is thrown in with a polyglot mass of humanity from every social strata, rich and poor, highly educated and illiterate, rabbis and atheists, the kind-hearted and the selfish, the courageous and the cowardly. He says that a common fate has made them all equal. They are used to being filthy, hungry, and exhausted. They are used to daily humiliations and frequent horrors, many deaths every day. Many of them say that God has abandoned the world, that he has withdrawn from it altogether, and that he has left no deputy. Early every morning, Simon marches in a line of prisoners to a work site outside Lemberg concentration camp. Local citizens on the street barely notice them. They are written off as doomed, eliciting no more sympathy than a herd of cattle being driven to a slaughterhouse. Every day, he marches past the old Lemberg High School where he was once a student, often bullied because he was Jewish. He also passes a cemetery where fallen German soldiers are buried. That's why these are here. Each with a beautiful sunflower planted on his grave. Wiesenthal finds himself fixating on these sunflowers. He notes their vibrant color and the butterflies flying from flower to flower. He contrasts these lovely green grave plots with the filthy mass graves of his people. Every fallen German soldier gets an honored place of remembrance. His entire race is being systematically annihilated, even their skulls and heels pounded to dust if the ovens don't consume them. Then one day, as he is marching past the high school, he is suddenly pulled out of his work line by a German army nurse. She quietly asks him a question. Are you a Jew? Obviously. She orders him to follow her inside the high school, which has been converted to an army hospital for wounded top German officers. She leads him upstairs to a small room that used to be the dean's office. Simon feels a mounting dread. He's not allowed to leave his work unit. He could be shot for it. He's tempted to just break and run. But the nurse pushes him through the door, says, "Stay here," and leaves. The room is hot, airless, and in semi-darkness. But he can make out the figure of a man lying on a bed, an SS officer. His head is heavily bandaged. There are openings for his nose and mouth, but not his eyes. His hands are white and bloodless. One of those hands gestures for Simon to come closer. Then in a parched voice, he says, "My name is Carl. I must tell you something dreadful, something inhuman." Carl knows that he has very little time left, and he feels compelled to make a confession to a Jew. Any Jew will do. "I was not born a murderer," he begins, reaching out to take Simon's hand, which Simon reluctantly allows him to do. Carl tells him that he grew up in a loving Christian family. His mother was a devoted Catholic, never missed a Sunday in church. His father was less devout, but sternly anti-Hitler. He was deeply concerned when his son started talking about volunteering to serve in Hitler's elite ranks of officers, the SS, Hitler's protection squadron, the most brutal Nazis of them all. For the young Carl, that elegant uniform promised prestige and power and adventure, a chance to make a name for himself in the glorious future of the Third Reich. He dismissed his father's strident warnings as the tiresome words of an old man who simply didn't understand modern times. Such words might sound familiar to all the parents and grandparents here. There was the second line I would like you to take with you today of all of them. There was no time for reflection in those days. He says that to Simon, I think, by way of excuse, perhaps, for his youthful ignorance. Events happened very quickly around him, as he was at a very impressionable age. Time went fast, lots of changes, very similar to our time. Instinctively, Simon pulls his hand away from Carl. Carter's my grandson. Deeply disturbed by what he is hearing, but Carl starts to tremble and reaches for it again, whispering, "Please." "Why not call for a priest?" Simon asks, but Carl insists he has to confess to a Jew. Simon notices the man's bones protruding through his sweat-soaked shirt. His mind is obviously in terrible turmoil. And so, because Simon feels sorry for the man, despite his revulsion, he takes his hand again. He even swats a fly away, was buzzing around the yellow-stained bandages on his head. And for the next 2 hours, he listens to the whole history of Carl's military career. What a difference between human beings. Carl confesses that, without a thought, he followed all orders, believing that Hitler's dream required a necessary toughness, a disinfecting of Europe, so that new history could be made and the German people rise to their rightful place in the world, free of the demonic Jewish vermin. He says there was a time when he felt sorry for the Jews in his hometown. They were often persecuted, beaten, and humiliated in the street. He even tried to give them a little extra food. But that was before he learned that Jews were the cause of all the war, poverty, hunger, and unemployment in his country. That they were at the heart of all the world's misfortunes. Scapegoat. And so, without a thought, or second thought, his sympathy for the Jews vanished and he became a willing executioner. Carl says he's been lying in this wretched hospital bed for 3 months. He has finally had some time for thought and reflection. There is one particular atrocity that he committed a year ago that won't let him rest. He says that if he doesn't tell it to Simon, he will go mad. And so Simon listens. In a little town in Poland, set ablaze and abandoned by the Russians, the SS marched in and were ordered to move toward a huddled mass of Jews in the town square. And I'll just read a short passage in his own words. He says this is Carl speaking. There were 150 of them, or perhaps 200, including many children who stared at us with anxious eyes. A few were quietly crying. There were infants in their mother's arms, but hardly any young men, mostly women and gray beards. A truck arrived with cans of petrol, which we unloaded and took into a house. The strong men among the Jews were ordered to carry the cans to the upper stories. They had to obey. Then we began to drive the Jews into the house. A sergeant with a whip in his hand helped any of the Jews who were not quick enough. There was a hail of curses and kicks. The house was not very large, only 3 stories. I would not have believed it possible to crowd so many people into it. But after a few minutes, there was no Jew left on the street. Then another truck came up full of more Jews, and they too were crammed into the house with the others. Then the door was locked and a machine gun was posted opposite. When we were told that everything was ready, we went back a few yards and then received the command to remove safety pins from hand grenades and throw them through the windows of the house. Detonations followed one after the other. Oh God. We heard screams and saw the flames eat their way from floor to floor. We had our rifles ready to shoot down anyone who tried to escape from that blazing hell. The screams were horrible. Dense smoke poured out and choked us. Behind the windows of the second floor, I saw a man with a small child in his arms. His clothes were on fire. By his side stood a woman, doubtless the mother of the child. With his free hand, the man covered the child's eyes. Then they jumped into the street. Then from the other windows fell other burning bodies. We shot them. I don't know how many tried to jump out of the windows, but that one family I shall not forget. Least of all the child. It had black hair and dark eyes. After this confession, Carl falls silent for a few minutes, shattered by the telling of it. But then he revives and he tells Simon that 3 months ago, something strange happened to him on the battlefield, a kind of vision or flashback or haunting. He was climbing out of the trenches on an order to attack the Russians. But then he says, something seized me. My hands, which held my rifle with fixed bayonet, began to tremble. In that moment, I saw the burning family, the father with the child and the mother behind them. And they came to meet me on that field. No, I thought, I cannot shoot them a second time. And then a shell exploded by my side and I lost consciousness. Carl's dawning moral awareness is, of course, good, but it's late. What's done cannot be undone, Lady Macbeth said to her husband as he fell into black depression after killing the king. But perhaps saddest of all, Simon is not even shocked by what he's just heard. This same thing has happened in other towns. Like the beheadings, the rapes, and other atrocities committed by warring countries today, it was common practice. So here we have the dilemma. The officer's repentance does seem sincere, if not complete, but does he have a right to Simon's pity, to your pity? Can he possibly expect one randomly chosen Jew to forgive all the evil he's done to countless other Jews? Or is Carl simply out of his mind? Yet, astoundingly, Simon still does feel pity for him, despite what he suffered from the Germans. Simon's still human, in the best sense. His instinct is to relieve suffering, if he possibly can. But then Carl says something that tips the scales. Look, he says, those Jews died quickly. They did not suffer as I do, though they were not as guilty as I am. Then he adds, I know that what I am asking is almost too much for you, but without your answer, I cannot die in peace. And so Wiesenthal sums it up. Page 54 here. Says two men who had never known each other had been brought together for a few hours by fate. One asks the other for help, but the other was himself helpless and able to do nothing for him. I stood up and looked in his direction at his folded hands. Between them, there seemed to rest a sunflower. At last, I made up my mind, and without a word, I left the room. Once he was back in the camp that evening, he did not get shot. Simon discussed what happened to him with his three prisoner friends, Adam, Arthur, and Joseph. All three told him, you did the right thing, that the Nazis' despair was the beginning of his punishment. One less, Arthur says contemptuously, as so many Germans said of the Jews. Simon does not tell them about his fascination with the sunflowers in the German cemetery. It embarrasses him. how he envied the men in those peaceful graves and had a longing to have a sunflower of his own. There's a PS in the essay. Carl died the day after his talk with Simon. When his column marched past the hospital the next day, the nurse again pulled Simon out of the line. But this time, she only wanted to give him a small bundle of Carl's possessions. Carl wanted Simon to have them, all except for his first communion watch, which would be sent to his mother. Simon refused to accept the bundle. He faced two more long years in concentration camps, including Buchenwald and Mauthausen. When the war finally came to an end, his three friends were long gone, one from typhus and the other two shot. But sometimes Simon still thought about what had happened between him and the dying German. Had he been right in refusing his request for forgiveness? Should he have just maybe pretended to forgive him to relieve his agony? Did he have anything to reproach himself for? And one final twist. After the war, Wiesenthal decided to visit Carl's mother in Stuttgart, who was living alone in a shattered old apartment building. On the bare walls was one photograph of her only child, Carl. So Simon finally got to see what he looked like. She obviously cherished his memory, thought of him as a good boy who would never do anything cruel or dishonorable. He was a favorite of their old priest who wanted Carl to study theology. But she conceded that in those days, they set children against God and their parents. The Nazi Party radicalized ambitious young men. Not all, some resisted, but not very many comparatively. After he joined Hitler Youth, he refused to ever go to church again. His mother used to have pictures of the saints on the walls of her house until Carl ordered her to take them down, and she obeyed. After her son put on his SS uniform, her husband barely spoke to him. He told his wife that Hitler had stolen Carl from them and bitterly wrote him off as their son. Carl went off to war without a single word from his father. I understand and admire that father. Yet ironically, because his son was in the SS, he and his wife were protected from all suspicion and harm, even as many of their neighbors were taken away. Because the father refused to join the Nazi Party, he was passed up for promotion again and again, and later died when the factory he worked in was bombed. Simon decides to say nothing to this unhappy woman about what Carl really did in the war. He concludes on page 91, and it's really another question that he asks all of us, what would you have done? I looked at the old lady who was clearly kind-hearted, a good mother and a good wife. Without doubt, she must often have felt sympathy for the oppressed, but the happiness of her own family was of paramount importance to her. There were millions of such families, anxious only for peace and quiet in their own little nests. These were the mounting blocks by which the criminals climbed to power and kept it. Should I tell the old lady the naked truth? No, I took my leave without diminishing in any way the poor woman's last surviving consolation, faith in the goodness of her son. Render to no man evil for evil. Perhaps it was a mistake not to have told her the truth. Perhaps her tears might help to wash away some of the misery of the world. I reflect that people like him are still being born. People who can be indoctrinated into evil. Will we ever be able to prevent the creation of mass murderers? Simon concludes with a fact which astounded me when I read it. Carl died at age 21. An old man. Okay, that's all I'm going to say today. Do you have any questions or comments that you would like to make? Have you read any other books on this subject that you would recommend?
This group just finished hearing a presentation over 3 or 4 weeks about the civil rights movement. There's a lot of hard stories in that era of human history. And it called to my mind a comment that I read about a parent who was protesting that the Civil War and human rights was taught in her children's classes. I suppose it was maybe junior, senior high.
Mm-hmm.
But what is our responsibility? Do we have a responsibility of teaching our children these difficult stories about human nature? Because this woman's comment was, I don't want my children to feel bad. So you were a teacher. Did you ever have any feedback from parents when you brought up this subject as you
the did? Only negative feedback, I was very lucky. I was
it was at a different time, probably.
Well, a different time, and I taught at the Ellis School, which was, they pretty much gave us the right, you know, to write our own curriculum and teach the books we wanted to teach, with of course the head's approval. And both the students and the parents were very eager for their kids to be well-educated. They wanted them to get into the best colleges and all that kind of thing. There were two things that happened, and that was with respect to racism in this country, not the Holocaust. One was, I had a poster in my room. I'd stuff all over the walls. And one was an old poster, which was an announcement of an upcoming sale of slaves in the town square, and, you know, advising people to come. This is top quality goods here. And one day, one of the open house days, one parent, a Black woman, a mother, said, why do you have that on the wall? And my specialty was American literature. I said, because it's part of the American story and we need to face it and not pretend it never happened. So that was good. The other problem was withdrawing the Adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the curriculum because it uses the N-word. And Twain knew what he was doing. He was writing in that time, not ours. And it is important, actually, to the meaning of the book, how that word is used, in what context, and by whom. So I was very frustrated by that. I was very sorry. But relative to the Holocaust, no, I've never had a parent complain about it, which amazes me, because so much of it is dark. And kids, you know, they think their kids are going to be terrorized or whatever. And I understand that objection. My interest in this subject actually began when I was 10 years old. It was traumatizing, actually. I was in our house, it was late in the evening, came downstairs. My parents were in the kitchen, but the television was still on. They just not bothered to turn it off. And I just happened to enter the room as they started showing films of the liberation of Auschwitz. And I saw those pyramids of corpses crisscrossed like empty flour sacks or something. There was nothing left of them. The Nazis called them rags. And there was some music playing in the background. I forget what it was, but it certainly even exaggerated the power of it. but you could see the horror and shock of the soldiers who were there and looking around. They cannot believe what they are seeing. This is a new low for humanity. It hit me so hard. I was horrified that any human beings could ever possibly do that on such a mass scale to other human beings and not have pity or guilt or something putting it to a stop. That night, I had no idea that I was just seeing films from one camp, that there were countless others and ghettos with unspeakable conditions, and that so many people just looked away. Your point is kind of to that point. We don't want to see it. Of course we don't. We want to be happy. We want to be secure. We want to protect our children from revelation of what human nature really is and why the teachings of Christ are so crucially important to our behavior. So that was the beginning for me. I think I grew up that night. I didn't sleep at all. It took many years for me to settle myself enough to actually start studying it. And the more I studied it, the more committed, I guess, I came to trying to understand it. What happens to people that can bring a society to such a point in a Christian country? So I can recommend so many wonderful books to you that have been very, very helpful to me. There are a million books on the Holocaust now. Hitler said that he believed that the Reich would last for 1,000 years. That was what his hope was. I think it's going to take 1,000 years for us to process World War II.
I was curious, yes. Did you discuss it with your folks?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Scared to. My dad was in the Battle of the Bulge, never discussed the war.
Okay.
Which I guess was typical of a lot of men. When they came home, my father had 4 daughters, no sons. I bet if we had been sons, he might have talked to us a little bit.
So you digested this all by yourself?
Yeah. Tried to figure it out.
A couple of things. I was probably almost as young as you when I, but that's because we had family who were in the military and who served. Mm-hmm. And although they didn't talk about it, they danced around, like they would give you little parts of it to make you curious enough,
yeah,
to be historic. So my love of history then started with Civil War and then went right to World War II. What bothers me about what the lady said about, you know, why are you teaching that?
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to, she wants to erase everything that's happened and she wants to again start anew, like what, you know, mm-hmm. Wiesenthal had to deal with. You know, you can't teach every piece of history in school, but you need to teach the big stuff that makes you not want to ever do that again. And I, you know, it bothers me with also teachers in my family who have just kind of been fine with exiting as they are sort of told what they can't, what they shouldn't teach. And if we don't teach that,
no,
it will and could be already in many parts of the world,
yes,
happening again. And I think that the bad comes with the good. I mean, you've got to know what happened.
Yes.
Books too. I mean, the only good book I think I read was The Happiest Man on Earth.
The what? I'm sorry?
Happiest Man on Earth. So it was written by somebody it was published, I think, just after he died at the age of 100. And he was a survivor. And he, you know, he writes the bad. But he's somebody who you almost can't imagine what his character and makeup was to be able to look at things in a way that then you say to yourself, I could never have been as high of an individual.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
You know,
right? Yes. John.
Even though I grew up in
Washington. Even though I grew up in Washington, D.C., Sue and I had sort of came to an awareness, you know, early in our days. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. And I remember as a little kid, you know, visiting my friends. And in almost every household, you know, and as you went up the stairs or you went into the family room, there was scores of photographs. And I remember on a couple of them, I said, my goodness, you know, who are all these people? And the answer was, these are our relatives. That's my uncle. That's my grandmother. All died in the Holocaust. And that got me thinking. I mean, there it was, you know, and these all these people had stories. But growing up with that, you know, certainly sensitized me to the whole situation. And I began to read, too, probably about the same time. Actually, I'm older. I'm 3 years older than Sue. But we started reading, I think, about the same time.
In some ways, too, as a believer, because I was a very, very religious kid, kind of, I look back on it now, and I thought, boy, my parents must have thought I was kind of weird. I would weave crowns of thorns at Easter from the rose bushes in the backyard. Very, very much involved in morality and ethics and philosophy and all of that stuff. It's what I love. And it worries me a little bit. All my grandchildren are in the sciences. What's happened to the humanities department? But you can see what the results of that are. People not knowing how to talk to each other, and you pile on that high technology, kids staring at their phones all day and looking at news sources that could be telling them who knows what. You don't know. We have so little control. Goebbels said that they could have not accomplished what they did in Nazi Germany without the radio as a means of propaganda. Imagine what can be done today when, you know, rumors, lies, deceptions can go around the world 25 times while truth is still putting on its shoes. How do we fight this? What do we do? The only hope we have is teaching. And it has to be taught properly. We do not want to demoralize kids about human nature altogether, certainly not. The one great advantage of studying this is that in balance to all the horrors, you read stories of such heroism and selflessness of people hiding Jewish people, their children, even babies in their house, at infinite risk to their own families. If they're found out, they all die. And the effort, trying to think which book it was, the Warsaw Ghetto, there was an uprising there. And somehow the word has gotten out that Jewish people were just sheep, they didn't rebel or anything. Not at all. Considering what resources they had, it's amazing they did what they did. But in 1943, there was an uprising in the ghetto. There were little kids, I was there, and you can see where little kids used to crawl underground through the cemetery to get weapons and food and the kinds of things they needed for some kind of rebellion. They didn't stand a chance, but they held them off for 17 days, which is amazing. And that scared the Nazis so much that finally they decided to close the ghetto and get rid of it altogether. Same thing in Treblinka, a great uprising. And finally they decided, okay, we don't want this happening anymore. Treblinka is an amazing place to visit if you can go there. It has a great beauty and peace about it. They preserve these places like national parks, really. But all the ground you walk on is a cemetery. And at any rate, I would not ever want to teach kids this story without that part of it as well. Amazing courage and strength and endurance. A Auschwitz survivor named Howard Chandler went with us on our trip, and he was such a useful source of information. Even now, he's got to be 90 by now, but he knew his way around Auschwitz and Birkenau. And he said, no, you don't have to go that way. Follow me. He was just a little boy when he was there, but he was young, scrappy, and knew ways to get around like a little mouse in the camp and to make friends with an SS officer who would give him a candy bar or something if he really polished his shoes properly. Amazing stories he had to tell, but he lost much of his family.
You've obviously been thinking about this and reading about it for a long time. So if you've had a chance to talk to God and ask God, why did you create men and women with the capacity to do such shocking evil?
Thanks.
What was your reason for giving us that ability?
The best I can do to answer that question for myself is, again, I guess, go right back to Genesis. He took a terrible risk in giving us free will. He's not going to make us be good people because it would be meaningless. We wouldn't have chosen it. Free will maybe was a risk that he repents of. I don't know. I don't know where we're going anymore. I was a pretty optimistic person, really, when I was having my kids. But I see so many kids and adults as well making crazy choices with the substance abuse, certainly, which is all over the place. The kinds of entertainment they watch, where some of it just seems to me to waver between perverse and colossally boring. Their inability to make conversation. They're looking at the phones so often that real relationships aren't fostered. So I guess I would just have to say that I hope he hasn't given up on us, and that history has been going like this from the very beginning anyway. We have free will. We can destroy this world if we want to, if we insist on doing it. The earth abides forever. Yes, it will, but perhaps not as beautiful as it once was. I don't know. I do have faith, though, in that part of us that is also very good and heroic and transcendent and able to overcome evil. And we won the war. It just was at such a high cost. Anyone else want to comment on that? That's a good question. Yes.
So my comment in listening to all this would be that sin is a real downer. And we often, you know, even in these seminars, don't really want to dwell on sin. But what goes with the recognition of human depravity is the infinite nature of God's grace. And when you put those two together, it's a pretty hopeful picture. But if you try to deny the depravity of humans, you diminish the importance of grace.
Yes. And remember that what Simon is talking about here is not really God's forgiveness. It's talking about human forgiveness. What can we forgive of evils done to ourselves or others or whatever? But I think, are we out of time?
We are.
Okay. Thank you very much, folks, for coming so early. Yeah.
Come back for more.
Operation Finale. Finale. Finale.